Hey there. Thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. If you like what you hear, we'd love if you subscribe to or followed the show in your favorite podcast app. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. And if you can leave a rating or review while you're at it, we would really appreciate it. It helps us a lot. And telling your friends about the show helps too. Thanks. Now, here's today's show. A bill restricting gun sales is inching forward in Texas. It's Tuesday, May 9th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Kalyani Saxena. Today on the show, we hear about a new book exploring the impact of Alzheimer's on a family. And it's No Mow May, a month-long environmental campaign that asks you to rethink your lawn. But first, let's turn to Texas, where yesterday a House committee advanced a bill raising the minimum purchasing age for a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21. It was a surprise to many who expected the bill to languish in committee due to widespread Republican opposition. The bipartisan vote came just days after a gunman killed 8 people at an outdoor mall in Allen, Texas, with an AR-15-style rifle. And 3 weeks shy of the one-year anniversary of the Uvalde shooting, which left 19 children and 2 adults dead last May. While the bill still has a long road to passage, this step forward is welcome news to Brett Cross. He lost his 10-year-old son, Uzziah Garcia, at Uvalde last year. He spoke with Deepa Fernandez earlier today. We heard those cheers, Brett, erupting in the committee room when the bill got enough votes to advance. What was that moment like for you?
So it was almost surreal. If you watch the video, you can see everybody cheering, but the families who lost kids in Uvalde, we were still stunned. And it took a few seconds for us to realize that they had actually voted yes to get it out of committee.
I mean, you and other family members have been pushing for this and more, I must say, since that moment. The images that you mentioned from the Austin State House of the mothers, the fathers, the children protesting was so powerful. Is this a sign to you that your message is finally getting through?
Yes, ma'am. And I think what it is I think that people are starting to see that the government, we don't work for the government. The government works for us. And we, the people, have more power than we think. So I feel like this is a strong symbol that we can get stuff done if we come together and push for change.
And I want to ask you, Brett, because obviously the Democrats are behind you, but there's never been really willingness on the Republican side. This is just the first step for this legislation. It made it out of a House Select Committee. What do you make of their decision? Do you see some new willingness from Republicans in legislation to tighten gun laws?
Yes, ma'am, I do. And I think it's coming to the point where people are starting to vote with their morals instead of just party affiliation. I think our stories touch them, you know, the images that we have shown them of our children and, you know, videos of them playing, and they're no longer here. So I think that it is coming to a head where people are starting to realize that this is real. Like, this isn't just something that you see on TV. This happens to everyday citizens everywhere. You know, it's not a matter of if it's going to happen to you. It's a matter of when.
Yeah. And it just did happen again this past weekend, another mass shooting at the Outlet Mall in Allen, in which a 5-year-old was killed. But Brett, that shooter was 33. So I'm just wondering, raising the age to buy a semi-automatic rifle, it's currently 18. The bill says it would raise to 21. That wouldn't have stopped what happened in Allen. How do you think it might help in the future, though?
So, you know, if you look at the majority of these school shootings, that is where it will more than likely help the most, is because our shooter had just turned 18. If you look at the shooter in Santa Fe, in Parkland, all of these, you know, Sandy Hook, all of these shooters are under the age of 21, and they're going back into schools, mostly the schools that they went to do this. But this is Texas, and we know that we want an assault rifles ban federally, but we know we're not going to get that in Texas. So Texas, we have to fight for what we feel is possible. And 18 to 21 isn't that big of a stretch.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you that it's kind of step one. Now the bill is headed to the House Calendars Committee, which sets the schedule for the full legislature. You're meeting with the Calendars Committee today. What's the likelihood that this bill will get another vote?
I have hope that, you know, that they will, but so far from the meetings that we've gotten, it doesn't seem like they're willing to. And unfortunately, Dustin Burrows is the chair of that committee, who voted no yesterday. And so we went and talked with his staff and everything. And, you know, their staff was like, well, he made it pretty clear with his vote. And I'm like, but let other people vote on it. Let's bring it to the floor and let's do this, because this is something that Texas doesn't do, but Texas is falling behind. Texas is not the Texas that, you know, we grew up in and that we were raised in. This is a Texas that cares more about money and guns than it does the actual people. And there's only so long that you can choose money and guns over people before the people fade away, and all that's left is the money and the guns.
Brett, I want to ask you about how you and your family are doing. It's been almost a year since you lost 10-year-old Usaya. How are you all doing?
We take it day by day. You know, we like to say that we don't really have good days, but we have all right days, and those are the days that we strive for. And we just take it day by day. If we can make it through another day, then that's another day. You know. And so, I mean, we work through it, we push through it, you know, we're in therapy, you know, but it's hard. And it's something that, you know, we will live with for the rest of our lives. And that is why we fight so hard, so that other people don't have to go through this.
Brett Cross lost his 10-year-old son in the Uvalde school shooting last year, and he's at the Austin State House pushing for tighter gun laws. Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Deepa speaks with author and cardiologist Sandeep Johar about his new book, My Father's Brain, Life in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. That's after the break. According to the Centers for Disease Control, almost 6 million people in the United States over the age of 65 have Alzheimer's disease or related dementia. By 2060, that number is expected to rise to 14 million. As awful as those numbers are, they don't tell the full story of the devastating effects Alzheimer's has on not only the people suffering, but also their loved ones. That is the subject of a new book by author and physician Sandeep Johar. It's called My Father's Brain, Life in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. And he spoke with Deepa about the book.
Sandeep, your father was a scientist, an accomplished and really smart man. As it becomes clearer that your dad's suffering from memory loss, possibly dementia, what were the signs in his behavior that you noticed?
The first signs were he couldn't remember what he'd had for lunch. He couldn't remember the code that we had set up on his new safe, which was my mother's birthday. So that was really the first sort of telltale sign that something was wrong.
You know, and some of that memory loss, I think it might be really tempting to just say, well, that's what happens with age. Did that seem like a possibility to you and your siblings?
Yes, we were in denial, frankly. The fact is that, you know, it was really a question of degree. You know, you can forget the name of someone when you're at my father's age, you know, in his 70s, but to forget that you ever knew someone, or to forget that you had lunch, there were sort of more serious signs of memory loss.
And you're a cardiologist, and so is your brother. Yet you realized, as you say in the book, you didn't really know much about what was happening in the brain as Alzheimer's took over. Why did you think knowing what was happening to your dad's brain might help?
Alzheimer's and caregiving for someone with Alzheimer's is extremely frustrating. It's really easy to get angry, impatient. You know, when you don't know what's going on in the brain, when you don't have the sort of neurological script it's doubly frustrating. So for me, I didn't really initially understand that the Alzheimer's affects the part of the brain that encodes memories. That's where it starts. Then it moves to the part of the brain that processes emotions. So my father's sort of eventual violent outbursts, which just seemed so irrational, that made me so frustrated. I think it's just important to know what's going on in the brain. That was one of my goals in writing the book, is to explain the brain, memory, and sort of the history and science of brain degeneration, along with the personal sort of wrenching chronicle of what happened.
I mean, it's very powerful, and the honesty in your book about the raw and sometimes ugly side of caring for someone you love with dementia. You know, there were things that happened that were horrifying to you, probably would have horrified your dad, and you wrote about them. Could you tell us just one of those examples and why you chose to write about it?
My father eventually came to love his caregiver, but he couldn't accept certain basic facts that, for example, we have to pay her. He would say, well, she should work for free, or we're going to give her room and board. And when he would find out that we had to pay her, and I would tell him, I needed for a long time to tell him the truth, Dad, we are paying her, we're going to continue to pay her. He would react very violently. He would throw orange juice at her face, or once he tried to hit her with a wire hanger. I mean, very, very disturbing stuff that was so out of character to the sort of gentle man that he was.
And that also brings up a really interesting thing that you grapple with in the book, and it's kind of the issue of truth versus, I don't want to say lying, but I guess it is lying, just not telling the truth. And your siblings seemed a lot more comfortable because he would forget, whether it was about whether you were paying the caregiver or whether your mother had passed away. They felt comfortable when he asked for your mother, saying, oh, she's coming. And you had to tell him the truth, but you ended up realizing, and you too told him untruths. Talk to me about that journey.
You know, for the longest time, I needed to feel like he was still a part of my world. And for me, as a son, that meant that I leveled with him. Also, as a doctor, I was trained in a paradigm where, you know, you level with patients. You tell them what's going on. It felt that it was degrading his dignity to lie to him. But, you know, eventually I came to understand that it's different if you're lying for your own benefit or you're lying for someone else's benefit. And he couldn't process so many things. And to tell him over and over that, Dad, Mom died, and nothing we say is going to bring her back, eventually you realize as a caregiver that it's just not worth it, and it's cruel. And, you know, it took me some time to get to that point, but I think a lot of caregivers understand intuitively that caring for someone with Alzheimer's or dementia means that you have to give up your conceptions of truth, and a different conception of dignity arises, validating the person's reality.
Sandeep, it also struck me that what happened to your family might be happening to many families in dealing with dementia.
Yeah. That weird place that so many of us are, caring for aging parents, caring for growing children, being maybe spouses or partners. It's sort of like what I wrote in the book, that there's like a sort of triple point in water where it's a gas, a liquid, and a solid all at the same point. And that's the kind of the point that I found myself, where I was a son caring for his aging father. I was a father to my own children, and I was a spouse to my wife. And all those roles were in this sort of uneasy equilibrium.
Yeah. What kind of help is out there for people in your situation?
There's very little help. And dementia is an epidemic, and it's coming for all of us. It's coming for us as patients or as caregivers. And out of the $200 billion that is devoted to dementia care annually, the government covers $11 billion. The rest of it is covered by families. You know, we fortunately had some resources to hire someone to help us, but there was still so much work. And I struggle to fathom what families go through when they don't have any help.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that was not named in your book, but I definitely took from it. You were lucky to have a caregiver who was Indian, who understood your father. I wonder how important, even as the nation starts to grapple with the kind of care that people will need going forward, it just struck me so many times, if the caregiver wasn't Indian, I wonder if they would have stayed.
No. The fact that she understood the culture that he grew up in was so important. If we hadn't found someone Indian, I don't think my father would have accepted the care. I think he would have struggled and fought it even more than he did. But yeah, I mean, it's very hard to find these days. And I travel the country talking to families who are struggling with this. And one of the biggest problems is finding help and affording help.
One of the things I found fascinating, Sandeep, was that you not only traveled the country, you went around the world looking at other examples. I know where my family is in Australia. One of the first moves is to put in-home care by the government in people's homes to help them. You found an example in Holland. Tell us about that.
It's a fascinating dementia village. There's always this sort of struggle in elder care, dementia care, between sort of autonomy and security. We want to keep people safe. We don't want them to wander. We're afraid they'll fall. But in this dementia village, people are allowed to walk around. They can go to the fountain. They can go to the gardens. And there's always someone around who can help them get back home. But the staff are sort of hidden, posing as like gardeners and people working at the coffee shop. Exactly.
Do you think it could work here?
Absolutely. I mean, there are villages like the Hoogwijk, which is the name of the village in the Netherlands, that are starting up in this country, in San Diego, Atlanta. You know, but it also raises a sort of larger question of truth-telling. You know, when I was there, I sort of walking around and seeing these gardeners pretending to garden, but they're really sort of caretakers and looking out for people. It sort of struck me like a film set. But that's a small price to pay for allowing people to live with dignity and autonomy at the end.
You know, I want to end with the moral dilemma that struck you at the end of your father's life. And I think it happened kind of in his last week. And it was the question of whether to keep him on a saline drip.
Yes.
He'd stopped eating. He'd stopped drinking. He was getting close to death. And stopping the saline would have hastened his death. But you were resistant to doing that, even though he, your own father, had made it clear in writing to your brother years earlier that if he was ever to be in this state, he did not want to be kept alive.
Right.
But you struggled with it. And I found fascinating that one of the things you said was you had just eaten a dosa with him. You'd just taken him out to eat some days before. And there was some simple pleasure in that.
Yeah. Cognitive impairment and basic pleasure, happiness, are not inconsistent. The person who's cognitively impaired, their perspective changes. It maybe shrinks. My father still found a lot of pleasure in basic things like having dosa with me or having a mango lassi or eating ice cream. When he wrote his directive, it was when he was a active scientist, you know, writing for the top journals in the world. And of course he didn't want to end up in that state. But when he did end up in that state, he didn't seem unhappy to me. He never told me, look, I want to end this. I think we as caregivers, his children, were struggling a lot more with his dementia than he was by that point.
Sandeep Johara's book is My Father's Brain, Life in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. Sandeep, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, for many Americans, lush green lawns are a source of pride and joy. But proponents of the No Mow May movement are urging homeowners to take a pause from tending to lawns this month and preserve the habitat for birds, butterflies, and bees. While the campaign has prompted controversy across the country, conservationists say even a one-month break in mowing can make a real ecological difference. After the break, Robin Young talks to a participant and a conservationist about the movement. Stick around.
It's full-on spring, the landscape canvas in much of the country turning green, attracting birds, bugs, bees. whose habitat, whether they're burrowing into grass or hanging on a dandelion, is quickly obliterated by lawnmowers. But it's also No Mow May, a movement started by the nonprofit Plant Lifer in the UK in 2019, a pledge to not mow lawns in May to preserve habitat for early pollinators, butterflies, and bees. There are critics who say a month isn't enough or a wild lawn is unsightly. There have been lawsuits and angry city council meetings. We're going to speak to a conservationist, but first to the Parkside neighborhood of Buffalo, where Karima Bondi is president of the Willow Lawn Block Club and a huge fan of No Mow May. Karima, you're doing it, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Why are you doing it?
Well, I mean, I guess the short answer is to promote life. Pollinators are in serious decline, and we need them. You know, they're losing habitat, and of course, lawns usually involve lots of different herbicides and artificial fertilizers. So just to give them an extra boost in the spring, especially in urban and suburban areas where there isn't necessarily enough to really sustain them or to get a strong population going.
What is coming up on your lawn?
What's flowering now mainly in my lawn and what I see in my neighborhood are three things, which of course the ubiquitous dandelion and also clover and violets. All three of those things are wonderful for pollinators.
Well, and we're reading in Tom Atwell's column in the Press Herald in Portland, Maine, that violets provide the only food that some butterfly larvae can eat.
So many of these plants are really species specific, like that example with the violets, like milkweed for the monarchs. So eradicating them, which has kind of been our history since the 70s, is devastating to these populations.
Well, I'm going to add clover provides nitrogen to long grass. So these are great things that you want to have grow. But as you know, there are people who are against this. What do you hear on your block?
About half of our residents did it, and it's mainly been positive feedback. But neighbors, I mean, I've had neighbors say, I just can't do it. I understand. I just can't do it. And I understand that. In our country, the vision of the beautiful, manicured, every blade of grass the same height kind of thing, it has been very, very promoted by landscaping businesses, fertilizer companies, what have you. And what I would say to them was, you know, even if you could just do a little bit of your backyard, or even if you could mow every other week, or put a couple planters in that have native plants. You know, we don't want to make this a good guys, bad guys kind of thing.
Well, unfortunately, though, that is happening in some places because there are some towns that have laws about how high your grass can grow. So someone's gone to the Williamsville Village Board and asked them to come up with a resolution because you can't send violations to people because their grass is high and not send it to someone else because they have a No Mow May sign on their lawn. Some people are suggesting that maybe the No Mow May happens in the backyard so that people don't have to argue over the front yard.
Sure.
But, you know, we also know that there's going to be a point. We have cities in this country who've already outlawed lawns because of drought and water
issues.
That's
correct. Cities have outlawed it. The state of Minnesota is now paying homeowners to plant what they're calling bee lawns, a mixture of native grasses and clover, to replace the traditional turf that we're used to. A suburb outside of Buffalo recently had a controversy going, and the mayor of that township proposed that she would allow a 2-foot square amount of lawn not to be mowed, which, you know, that's the size of a pizza box. but even that, it's something. And I think the most important aspect of No Mow May isn't necessarily the height of our lawns. It's sparking conversations in communities.
Yeah. Karima Bondi in the Parkside neighborhood of Buffalo. She and her neighbors are doing the No Mow May. Karima, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, now let's bring in conservationist Deborah Landau. She's director of ecological management at the Nature Conservancy in Bethesda, Maryland. Deborah, we just heard what Karima thinks and hopes her 1 month of not mowing will do for pollinators and for birds. Really? Can 1 month do that much?
Well, 1 month can do a lot, and it's certainly going to provide a whole lot of habitat for those 31 days. But, you know, what it's absolutely doing is educating people. It's showing people the importance of maybe delaying mowing, of maybe considering lawn alternatives, and hopefully providing some examples of successful no-mow May attempts.
There's become this sort of competitive spirit about this. We know in Quebec, towns have offered prizes for the most dandelions in a lawn in the month of May, and Sir David Attenborough is a big proponent of this in the UK where it all started. But there might be a chance that a lot of these, you know, beautiful suburbs with their beautiful green lawns, relatively new in American history, this idea of suburbs and big green lawns, but they may end up being outlawed anyway because of lack of water.
Right. That's a really good point. And the key word you use is beautiful, because we've been taught that these pristine golf course type lawns is what's beautiful. But I think we can really learn to appreciate the beauty of a diverse habitat in your front garden, colors and structures and insects buzzing around. The banning is tough because people obviously don't want to be told what to do. But if they can learn to appreciate the beauty of diversity, then perhaps they'll voluntarily choose to convert, you know, if not all, maybe a portion of their lawn to a native pollinator garden.
Well, that's different from what's sort of happening in No Mow May, which is just, you know, let it go, see what comes up. You know, there are people, neighbors, who don't want to see it.
Right. Well, again, you know, weeds is kind of up to how you're going to define it. A lot of lawn services spray pesticides to kill the clovers, while other people are planting clovers because they're fixing nitrogen and they're providing pollen and nectar sources. We use 10 times more chemicals on our lawns in this country than we do on our agriculture to grow our food.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, if you've had a weed-free lawn and now you want to make a switch, beware, because we understand that if a lawn's regularly been treated with weed and feed fertilizer, it doesn't really help the pollinators if you start mowing, because you will have no flowers.
Yeah, you do have to have a period of time without chemicals.
So there's that. But you said outright bans may not be the way to go, but they're coming. A new Las Vegas law requires homeowners there to get rid of their lawns by 2027. And again, some of the stats, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council, maintaining lawns requires 3 trillion gallons of water, 200 million gallons of gas every year. Deborah Landau, again with the Nature Conservancy, do you think No Mow May be a portal for people to the future?
Yeah, so what it can do is give you a sense of perhaps what you can expect. I encourage people who are participating in this for the first time to slow down and see what's coming in, what's flying around, and think about what that organism represents. You know, obviously bees are going to pollinate the flowers that you expect to see in the spring and summer and the fall. At the same time, if you see caterpillars moving around, that's your food source for birds.
And town officials who are debating this, I mean, they're worried about their own liability. There was a man in Maryland who was fined for letting the clover and buttercups overtake his lawn because he loves them. A retired lawyer in Jacksonville, Arkansas, got citations from his town for turning 5 acres into a natural habitat. How do we square that?
Well, at the same time, on the flip side, there are people concerned about air quality from mowers. There are folks with kids who have asthma who have been seeking citations for their neighbors mowing so often that they're putting too many particulates into the air.
Hmm. If people absolutely can't let go yet of the green, is there a better grass? And again, I know that it's different all across the country, but is there a better kind of grass they can use?
Absolutely. And what you can do is go to your state's Native Plant Society or your Ag Extension Service and ask, what native plants are in my area and could I use them for my lawn? That might also have deeper roots. They might need less water and they might actually do better than the standard seed mixes that you're picking up at the hardware store.
Deborah Landau, she's with the Nature Conservancy. It is No Mow May. May your dandelion flourish. Deborah, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Sam Rafelson, Emiko Tamagawa, and Karen Miller-Medson. Todd Munt, Gabe Bullard, and Peter O'Dowd edited today's show. technical direction from Max Liebman and Mike Moschitto. Theme music by Mike, Max, and Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Grace Griffin and Allison Hagen. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.